EFF. Okay. Okay, please. We're going to talk about Yitzchak. We're going to talk about Yitzchak today. Yitzchak's a very enigmatic figure. When you think about it, it's almost like he's not there. Avraham Avinu has what? His story starts at the end of Noach. So you get all of Noach. You get the end, the last bits of Noach, Lech Lecha, Vayera, and a chunk, not all, but a chunk of Chayei Sarah. And in fact, most of, even if Avraham Avinu doesn't fit, you know, doesn't play a prominent role in most of Chayei Sarah, he's sort of like, his presence is hovering over. You know, we sent Eliezer to go get a shidduch for Yitzchak. I mean, he's there. And then finally he dies, okay? Then you have Yitzchak, who figures in exactly how many parshiot? One. Toldot is it. By the time we get to the end of Toldot, after Toldot's over, it's all Yaakov. Vayetze and Vayishlach and Mik, and even the Yosef story happens, you know, in the shadow of Yaakov. So Yaakov is really, he's really the prominent story all the way down, although Yosef sort of, steals some of the thunder towards the end. Yitzchak, mamish, one parsha. And what do we know about Yitzchak? Yitzchak, what did he do? What do we know that he did? If we go through the parsha, you see, first of all, he was, they had no children. He and Rivka had no children. Okay. And then God gave them twins. He gave them Yaakov and gave them Esau. And they had trouble with Yaakov and Esau from the very beginning because they were such two different personalities and so on. And then there was a famine. Yitzchak wanted to go to Yitzchak first went to the Plishtim. And then he thought to go to Egypt. Because who went to Egypt when there was a famine? Avraham Avinu. So what do? You do what he did want to do, his father did. God says, no, you're not allowed to go. He says, Vayomer Elav Hashem, this is Kavav, Vayomer Al Terad Mitzrayma, don't go down to Egypt, Shon Baaretz, stay here, Asher Omar Elecha. Okay? Live here, Vayayim Chav Arecheka, and so on and so forth. Very nice. Okay. He gives him a promise, and he says, and the reason why I'm going to give you the promise is because of Abraham. I don't know about you, but you know, living in somebody's shadow is not, I mean, I don't know if you have like brilliant, if your parents are famous or if you have older siblings who are like, you know, overachievers and you always think, oh, I'm never going to be like so and so. It's not easy. And the initial story is that Yitzchak, you know, is his brit is because of Avraham Avinu. On the contrary, and the parsha starts by telling us that that Yitzchak was a dead ringer. For at least Rashi says he was a dead ringer for Avraham Avinu. So a guy who met him on the street might have thought that it was the same person. Okay, so then he goes. And he has a whole thing with Avimelech. And what does he end up doing a lot of the time? He ends up re-digging, taking wells that Avraham Avinu had dug and that the Philistines had filled in and then, you know, re-dug them and called them the same names that Avraham Avinu had done. Okay? Let me ask you a question. So what kind of life did Yitzchak live? How would you characterize his life? Right, his entire life. His entire life is based on his father's life. He's reliving his father's life down to the same wells that his father dug. Okay? Even in this famous, you know, what's the most famous episode in the Torah that he's required, that's required. And something Yitzchak. Akedat Yitzchak, exactly. Excellent. Okay? Akedat Yitzchak is the episode that he stars in. So let me ask you a question. what kind of actor, what kind of role did Yitzchak, who according to Chazal at the time was 32 years old, what kind of role does he play? No? Is he active or is he passive? He's passive. He goes along with his father. He asks questions. He lets his father tie him up. Lets his father put him on the altar. Lets his father almost slit his throat. And then God comes out of the mouth. An angel comes and says, don't do it. But there's no, like, seemingly, Yitzchak, apparently, or at least at first blush, doesn't imprint doesn't put his personality onto it. Okay. So who's Yitzchak? I mean, who is this? Who is this personality? Who is this person who, one of the Avot, who, by the way, is the biggest hall in Ma'arat HaMachpelah, if you ever get there when Jews are available, allowed to go to visit the entire Ma'arat. What kind of person is this? So, here, in order to try to get some kind of appreciation of Yitzchak, the Rav starts off with a Kabbalistic motif. Okay? And it's not that often the Rav quotes Kabbalah, but already Chazal made a point of saying that there's a fundamental difference in personalities between Avraham and Yitzchak. Avraham is characterized by the personality trait of chesed. We talked about chesed. Chesed is what? Chesed is this desire to get out there and to give. And you give and you give and you give and you give and you give. And you give unstintingly. He was a full-time missionary trying to spread the word of God. He was a person who dealt with all kinds of people. In fact, just I'll mention in passing, one of the Rav's great-great-grandfather, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the Rosh Shiva Volozhin, who wrote probably one of the most important Perushim on Chumash in the modern era, called Hamek Davar. And if you ever have a chance to buy one, get one, because it's phenomenal. In the introduction to Bereishis, he sort of grapples with Rashi's question. Rashi at the beginning of Bereishis asks, how come if the Torah is meant to give dinim and the Torah is meant to give mitzvos, so why do we need Sefer Bereishis? It's a bunch of stories. They're very interesting, okay, very nice. But the fundamental, essential function of the Torah is to give mitzvos. So we should have started with HaChodesh HaZem. We should have started in the middle of Shmos and called it a day. So why do we need Sefer Bereishis? So we know that Rashi says the reason is because we have to have the story of creation to tell us that God is the owner of the world, and if he wants to give Eretz Yisrael to the Jews, he has that right. He can take it away from him. He can give it for the Canaanites to give it to us. And okay, that's Rashi's answer. But the Netziv says, no, that's not all. He says, Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah. At the end of the day, acting like a mensch is a prerequisite for being a religious Jew. So what do we learn from Sefer Bereishis? From Sefer Bereishis we learn how Avraham dealt with all kinds of people, and he was honest, and he wouldn't take money from the king of Sodom, and he fought for the Sodomites even if they were miserable, horrible people. He wanted to try to save lives. I mean, he dealt with all kinds of people, and he was out there with all kinds of people, and we have to learn how to be with all kinds of people too, and be a mensch first, and then we're able to, and to have derech eretz first, and to know how to deal with how to be a moral and an ethical person before we can even start thinking about any kind of ritual or religious life, because that is the basis of religious life, respecting everybody who's created in the image of God. That's one of the major basic building blocks of the Jewish religion. So anyways, but that's a function of Avram's chesed, that he was giving and giving and giving and giving and giving. Okay? Now, I'm going to add something here. Avram Avinu, though, did have a character flaw. Or at least he wasn't able to instill in his... In both of his children, this midah, or do it the other way, in this giving with no limits is not a good thing if it's taken to extreme. Nothing is good in extreme. My Bubba used to say, "Zu viel ist ungesund." Too much is no good. So, for example, Yishmael, okay, Yishmael was also a guy with absolutely no boundaries. He's a wild man. Yours is mine, mine is his. Everybody's at everything. He's out of control. All right? Too much love is also not a good thing. One of the prohibited sexual liaisons that the Torah describes in the book of Vayikra is a chesed. He says it's a chesed. What do you mean a chesed? Chesed is a good thing. You have chesed hours in the program, right? So chesed isn't always a good thing. Evidently not, because too much love, all right, without boundaries, can be perverted, all right. And Yishmael might have, on a certain level, had no boundaries. So Avraham Avinu knew how to do it, but that quality by itself can in fact be overdone. Yitzchak, according to Kabbalah, symbolizes or embodies a different kind of character trait, and that character trait is the character trait of Gvura.
Which we will translate as heroism or courage.
Now, the concept of heroism, the Jews have to live a heroic life, is a leitmotif. Everybody know what a leitmotif is? It's a permanent theme. It's a theme that a leitmotif in music is if you have a theme of music that runs through an entire piece, it's the leitmotif of the piece. So, for example, let me get an example that's well known. Ah, I know. Okay, in Beethoven's Fifth Symphony in C major, da 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 is the motif of the entire leitmotif of the entire piece. Or the love song in Romeo and Juliet by Tchaikovsky. However it goes, I can't sing it well now, right now. Okay, so the question of Gvura and the definition of Gvura are a central point of the Rav's thought. What is Gvura? So in this book, now the truth of the matter is I do have the English, but I forgot to bring it. In the 50s and the 50s, see how old this is. This was just recently reissued. I don't know. In the 50s and early 60s, after the Rav, you saw the movie that the Rav had switched from Aguda to become a religious Zionist, and he was the head of the religious Zionist movement in the United States, or the honorary president until the day he died. In the course of the 50s and 60s, he gave a series of very, very important drushes in which he explained his vision of Zionism, which is very different than that of Rav Kook. I mean, you must be studying some Rav Kook here, okay? The school's named after his son, so I'm assuming that that's the case. The Rav Zionism was very different than that of Rav Kook and that of his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook. The Rav Zionism was not one in which you have to perforce bring the Mashiach. The Mashiach is God's problem. Or God's issue, God's responsibility. The Rav saw the establishment of the State of Israel as a divine intervention in history, as a wonderful gift that Kadosh Baruch Hu gave us, for which we have to give thanks every single day. He did not think it was necessarily the final redemption. He did not think it was necessarily final geula. He would not have said, I assume, Reshit Smichat Geula Tenu in the Tefillah Shlom HaMedina, even though he was a very, very, he certainly was a very profoundly committed Zionist. Anyways, over the course of the 50s and 60s, he gave a series of at least six different major addresses to the religious Zionists of America on various aspects of his vision of Zionism, and trying to give a sort of shot in the arm to religious Zionists in America and abroad. Interestingly, the lectures he gave were in Yiddish, We forget that Yiddish used to be the most important Zionist language, not just Hebrew. And it was they were later translated. So anyways, the book, the English translation is called The Rav Speaks. And if you find it, if you want to read it, then I highly recommend it. The Hebrew is called Chamesh Drashot, Five Drashot. And many of the Yiddish are not available. There's a few of them that are available online. Excuse me. But the translation is fine. In any event, and so that was five. And the sixth famous drasha is a book called, became a book called Kol Dudi Dofek. Hark, my, or her voice, my lover, Knox. That was translated into Hebrew. And then there were two English translations, one of which I edited. So that's why I spent a lot of time with that. It was published by Ketav NYU Press. In any event, in one of the drushes, let me see which one this is. The Rav lays out the definitions of, in the second drusha, I guess, right? No, the third drusha. In the third drusha, in five drushes, which is called Abraham the Hebrew, he lays out the question of what is Gvura and what is Koach, and by extension, let's find out who Yitzchak was. So the Rav points out in his discussion here, he says there is a difference between gvura, which means heroism, and koach, which means power. Okay, power is physical force. An army goes in, it's overwhelmingly powerful, it wipes the floor with the enemy, and goes away. Like the Roman legion used to march in, boom, 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 goodbye, finished, they're done. Whatever they, you know, and there are many, many cases like that, okay? You don't have to be particularly heroic if you're powerful, because it's no bet. It's hardly any. It's not that there's no danger involved, but you know your confidence is very, very stated. Heroism usually comes from a person who's fighting against the odds. He's the person who, despite the fact that the odds are against him, despite the fact that he might even lose, despite the fact that perhaps he will probably lose, he will put up the best fight that he can out of absolute and an unflinching and uncompromising commitment to whatever it is he's fighting for. Sometimes even, okay, because that means that I'm willing to look at my limitations, in fact, perhaps even to glory in my limitations, and say, nevertheless, I will do the thing which is not easy. The easy thing when you are fighting or are trying to do something when it's hard is to give up. The hard thing, the heroic thing, is to do the thing that's hard. It's to take on the odds. All right. It's no big deal, God forbid, if the Arabs had marched in 48 or 67 or 73 and won, because they outnumbered us 3 billion to 1 or whatever it was. Heroism is when we took on the Arabs and won. And whether we would have won or lost, didn't matter. It was a heroic stand. Now, In terms of that, all right. So for example, and the Jew is required, and Jews are required, the Rav always said, to live a heroic existence, which means you don't do the easy thing. We never do the easy thing. The Torah demands that we not go the easy path. It's easy to assimilate. It's easy to convert. It's easy to eat if you don't have to keep kosher. It's easy to make a living. Well, it's never easy to make a living. That's wrong. But it's certainly easier to make a living if you, don't have chagim and Shabbos, and you don't have a family, as the Torah demands that you have, and you don't have to pay day school tuition, and you don't have to pay for tefillin and this and for that or for the other thing. That's easier. That's a no-brainer. It's harder, it's more heroic when you have the sacrifice of your money and of your time and of your essence and of your ambitions. Because the Torah says, I demand, the God says, I demand your time, I demand your food, I demand to tell you what to eat, and so on and so forth. The example the Rav used to love, I mean, he quotes this all over the place. There's a Medrash that describes, and the Rav thought this was the ultimate expression of heroism, and when you think about it, it's pretty amazing. The Medrash is of a chassan and a kala on their wedding night. Okay, they've been good boy and girl, they haven't had any contact beforehand, the party's finally over, they've come back from the hall, they spent the last 3 hours schlepping the packages into the apartment that they just rented, and finally they're able to be together, and he wants her, and she wants him, and this is an unbelievably sublime moment of romance and passion, and she looks down, and she's spotted. There's a spot of blood. Happened. And yet despite that, she sleeps over here, or because of that, I should say, and she sleeps over there, and they overcome what the easy thing to do in the name of the right thing to do. That, says the Rav, is the ultimate example of heroism. The Rav is not a very big fan of the Kennedys for all kinds of reasons, but it is true, one thing that President Kennedy said, he says, we will go to the moon not because it is easy, but because it is hard. Something similar to that. Just continually Jewish is a heroic existence. Trying to find favor in the eyes of the non-Jews is that takes no guts whatsoever. I mean, that's the easy pass. Okay, so what's that got to do with Yitzchak? If you think about Yitzchak's life, okay, Yitzchak is an individual who really does symbolize Gvura in the sense of, it's a person whose life is extremely disciplined. It's extremely circumscribed. It's true. He lives his life within very, very carefully delineated space, much of which was first set by his father. He doesn't really let his own personality come out. Question is why? I would suggest, this is my, I was looking for this in my notes, and I don't know if the Rav said it. It certainly lines up with things that he said. But if it's wrong, then it's my fault, and if it's right, it's his. So let's do it that way. Sometimes people who are incredibly brilliant and incredibly revolutionary are not able to regularize and to establish their revolution. In other words, people that are revolutionaries, they're not good at building institutions. They're not good at taking their ideas and taking this new world that they've sort of foreseen and started to put together and get people excited about, and to say, okay, we're going to build structures and communities and schools and all kinds of ways to make sure that the ideas of the founder are perpetuated. And they're not able to. What you need is people who are very, very disciplined. To say, okay, I know all the theories and all the great stuff, but now we're going to find how to build schools and how to build communities and how the ideals of the person who's the revolutionary should be taught and should be expressed and all kinds of stuff. Okay, and it's true in all kinds of revolutions. Okay, so I'll give you an example: Jewish revolution in the 12th century. There was a Jewish revolutionary Rashi's grandson, whose name was Rabbi Yaakov Tam, or otherwise known as Rabbeinu Tam. I assume you've heard of him at some stage of the ballgame. The Rabbeinu Tam was a out-and-out outrageous genius. He was just one of these people whose like mind was way ahead of every just bigger than the sum total of everybody around him put together. And he had wild insights, and he changed the method of Torah study and so on and so forth. But interestingly, he didn't write much. And it's not clear that he was able to really train and communicate to others what he was trying to get. But he had a nephew whose name was Rabbi Yitzchak of Dompierre, and this nephew actually went and said, okay, he was able to take the, I mean, himself was not no slouch in his own right, but he was able to take the new method and the insights and the direction and the derech halimud of his uncle, Rabbeinu Tam, and say, okay, I am now going to have students and I'm going to teach them how to think and how to analyze and how to paskin and how to study Torah the way that my uncle did. But I'm going to put it into a method that they can handle, rather than being blown away by Rabbeinu Tam. I say, who, and everybody would say, "Oh well, my God, nobody can be like that. Nobody can be that smart." So, in other words, the revolutionary was Rabbeinu Tam, but the person who was able to discipline the minds of others and create students who each in their own to their own ability were able to, you know, teach this new method and expand it and get new students and to really spread this new approach to Torah, okay, was Rabbi Yitzchak Dompierre. He was able to institutionalize it. Because if it up to Rabbeinu Tam, I mean, it's too much. You'd say, who could be like Rabbeinu Tam? And goodbye. And who knows, maybe there were plenty of times that Rabbeinu Tam got up like a lot of brilliant rabbis and say, Rabbi was brilliant, I didn't understand a word. Okay. Same thing happened Seven hundred years later, there's the Vilna Gaon, who's living in Vilna, and he's like, I forget it, nobody can be like him. But he did have a certain approach to learning, which was new at the time, but he wasn't the person to be able to make a school. He wasn't the person that was able to establish it. He wasn't the person that could make a community. He only had a few people that hung around him, that was it. It was one of his students, Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, who built the first yeshiva. Why? Because you have to be able to have the discipline and the structure of thought to be able to do that. If you think about Rabbeinu Tam and the Vilna Gaon, people who kept thinking and giving and giving and thought and all kinds of brilliant and intellectual ideas and new insights into Torah, blah, blah, blah. It's like Avraham Avinu with the Chesed, with the message of the one God. It's all very, all over the place. Comes Rabbi Yitzchak Dompierre and sets up schools. Comes Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin and sets up schools. And maybe they weren't as brilliant as the Gaon and the Rabbeinu Tam, probably not. But they were able to make it accessible. They were able to make it by, to a certain degree, living in the shadows of the great masters. If you look at things that way, then Yitzchak becomes more accessible. Okay? He was a person. He's a person who is very, you know, not limited, but he's very regimented. Gvura also requires discipline. Gvura also requires self-effacement. There's a certain amount of surrender involved in Gvura. If you're really going to be heroic, it means you're not going to sort of like tout your own horn. You're doing something for the greater good. So that here, what Yitzchak does, he says, okay, I look just like my father. I'm the only person who's inherited the tradition and the covenant from my father. And I don't have my father's charisma. He didn't. And the truth of the matter is, he's sort of a quiet, passive guy. So what does he do? First of all, he does certain homework, which is really very striking. He does his homework and he says, you know what? I'm not my father. I don't have his charisma. I don't have his personality. I'm not so dramatic. I'm not so out there. So what does he ask himself? He asks himself, who am I? Where can I make my own significant and unique contribution to the realization of the vision that my father had, that my mother had? Together, we talked about this last week, and he realized that what he has to do is basically follow literally in his father's footsteps, okay, to the extent that he's able to. Right? Now, what is that? Now, what does that end up meaning? It ends up meaning that, first of all, so he, but there's limits to that. He's not allowed to go to Egypt. He wants to go to Egypt. He needs food. God says, don't go to Egypt. Now, there are a number of reasons why we can understand God telling him, don't go to Egypt. So, according to Rashi, Rashi gives sort of a halachic explanation. He said, look it. He said, you were almost sacrificed on the altar. Chutz La'aretz not for you. Some people have to realize that they're not really made for the big world, for the broader world. Realize your limitations. Again, realize your limitations. Okay? Maybe Avraham Avinu, Yaakov, could go out and face a Lavan or face Pharaoh or whatever the case might be. That's not you. Realize your limitations, that you can't deal with Egypt, whatever, and all that Egypt is represented with its grandeur and its money on the one hand, and its power and its sexual and moral corruption on the other. So you stay in Israel on the one hand. On the other hand, he spends his time re-digging the wells the Philistines had filled up. So let me ask you a question. What does it mean to dig a well? When you dig a well, what does that do? Or when you plant a tree, what kind of statement is that?
Civilization.
It's civilization, correct, excellent. What else? It's the start of something new, but it's also a statement of ownership. If I dig a well, this is my well. Okay? If I plant a tree, I plant it in my backyard, it's a statement of my belonging. If the Philistines came and filled up the wells, what's the point? Right. We don't want you here. This is our territory. So exactly what I said before, it's true. Yitzchak didn't do anything new. I don't know if he could have or not, but he chose to stay within a very careful plan in which he relived Avraham Avinu's life and redug those wells, because evidently the wells that Avraham Avinu dug were not permanent or deep enough. He had to continue to assert whatever it was that what Avraham Avinu was trying to get across, that this is our country, that God gave it to us, and that the mission of the family of Abraham is to not just to live here, but also to expand the belief in the one God in this country. So in the same way as I mentioned, that's the reason why I mentioned the cases of Rabbi Yitzchak of Dampierre and Reb Chaim of Volozhin, and there are plenty of others like that. Okay? That you need to be able to deepen and to establish and institutionalize a revolution, or else it's not going to last. Avram's wells were exposed to being filled up. Yitzchak's lasted. So you sacrifice yourself for common good. That's heroic. That's really heroic. Now, in addition, so if five wells that he There's five wells that he rebuilds, and he stands up to them. It's interesting. He's not a wuss, Yitzchak. He takes on the shepherds of Grar, the Philistine shepherds, and he tells them, "Nothing doing." You know, if he were a wuss, he would have said, "Oh, you know." No, he's a minority in the country, and he's got to call upon. Inner strengths that maybe he didn't even think he had. Nevertheless, he stands up to them. This is mine, this is my father's, and that's it. And they back down. He's a minority in the country again. What do we say heroism is? It's not when you have 300 million soldiers behind you. It's when you stand up for what's right. And that's also a form of Wura. Now as with Avraham Avinu, okay, children don't always understand. Children don't always understand their parents, just like parents usually don't understand their children, or often don't, or all too often don't, or whatever the case might be. So let's look at the two children. Let's look at Yaakov. Let's look at Esav. Okay? So, what kind of person was Esav? Forget about the Medrash Committee. Just from the stories that we know. What do we know about Esav? What's bad about him? Yes, I know what Chazal say about him. But just based on the stories, what kind of person is he? Let's see what happens. He comes out. He's redhead. And he's very hairy, and that's why he's called Seir, and he's called Esav. Okay. Finally, they got dressed, and they let's look in cafe. They grow up, and Vayehi Esav Isho Deatzayid Ish Sadeh. He's a person who knows how to hunt. He's out there. He's a hunter. He's wearing a red plaid. He always wearing a red plaid, red plaid flannel shirt and a red plaid flannel hat. And he's out there with the hunting guns. And he's one of those people that when you drive down the East Side Highway in the fall, there's all these people coming back from northern New York with Bambi on the front of the back of their car or the top of their car. That's Esav. Okay, he's living in, he's a guy, he's a field guy, he's a survivalist and whatever. Yaakov Ishtam, he's more retiring, he's more of intellectual, he hangs the tents. And Yitzchak loved Esav. Why did Yitzchak love Esav? Kitzayit Befiv. Because he was a real... Now, according to Chazal, that meant he used to deceive him. But let's go with the simple meaning of the verses. He was a guy who was he was the opposite of Yitzchak. Yitzchak was not this really, he wasn't this fighter and whatever. He was, it was hard for him, he was heroic. But he liked this kid that was out there, and he was shooting, and he was doing whatever he was doing. Rivka loved Yaakov, okay. And so, and then one day Yaakov makes a porridge, and comes Esav from the field, and he says, "What the hell do I need this bechora for?" And he says, "You know what? I just need, just give me something. I'm fine." Okay. Now, and he's a violent guy, and he's impulsive. And he goes out and marries a non-Jewish woman, or a woman who met from a Canaanite family, and the Canaanites were really talk about immoral bunch of people. Okay? Does he have Gvura? Is he heroic? He's out there fighting, and he's got a sword, and he's got a, and he's shooting his arrows and all kinds of stuff. No? What kind of person do you think that is? He's violent, he's powerful. Okay? Exactly. He got confused between power and heroism. He thought that that's what he's supposed to do. Okay, now it happens to be that military life requires discipline. Say he's a soldier. Even being a hunter requires discipline. And his failing was the fact that he mixed up the discipline of the soldier and the discipline of the spiritual hero, the person who is able to do the right thing and give up on his own. He's interested in using that discipline in order to be able to get whatever he wants, which is, you know, he wants the porridge, and he wants the blessing, and he wants this woman and that woman, and the other way he wants it, whichever deers he's going to bring in, whatever the case might be. Okay. And Yaakov realizes that this is not the kind of personality who's going to be able to carry on the blessing of Abraham. Okay? Interestingly, Yitzchak doesn't see the difference. Evidently, being totally gvura can blind you. Now, I don't know exactly how that worked. I wasn't there. But it is true that Yitzchak was blind. He couldn't see. He couldn't see who Esav really was in that regard. That's the reason, by the way. But you see, interestingly, there's a Chazal already pointed out that there was a fundamental difference between Avram and Yitzchak on the one hand and Yaakov on the other. And with all the stuff about Yaakov that we will talk about, please God, in terms of his ability to be able to, you know, set things up appropriately for his own, for himself, okay? But, and he's a sharp operator, no question. But let me ask you a question. What is the difference in terms of the results? No? What kind of children do they have? What was the story with Avraham Avinu's children? You had two sons. Who are they? Yitzchak and Ishmael. Very nice. And what kind of guy was Ishmael? We just talked about this. Yeah, and he was a wild man. Okay? So he was chesed gone crazy. Alright? Yitzchak worked out okay, but he was gvura. He was the opposite. He was like a yin and yang to Avraham Avinu. Okay? Then you look at Yitzchak's kids. You have Esav, who is a misunderstanding and misappropriation of Gvura, confusing physical force with a lack of vision, you know, the vision thing, a vision with Gvura. And Yaakov, what about Yaakov's kids? All of them okay. They all work out all right. All 12 children stay with the plan. Yishmael leaves, he marries some Egyptian woman, goes off and does whatever he does. Esav marries one of Yishmael's kids, but then and also with the Canaanites. They leave, there's no continuity. Everything's gone from Avram to Yitzchak and Yitzchak then to Yaakov, but Yaakov, all 12 sons. And that's why Yaakov is called Bechir Sheba Avot. He is the choice, he's the best, he's the one that really succeeded. As Kimitato Shlema, meaning all of his kids turned out right. What was it about Yaakov that made this happen? So according to the Rav, according to the Kabbalist, because Yaakov realized that too much chesed is no good unless it's countered with limits. And too much limitations without emotion, without creativity, without being out there, without giving, all right, is also no good. You have to combine the two. And Yaakov combined the two. But it was necessary for Yitzchak to be able to give the set the example of knowing how to be disciplined and knowing how to be able to swallow your own ego in the interest of a higher calling, he had to set that example in order to be able for Avraham Avinu's vision to be able to translate into reality. Some people build institutions and some people are thinkers, and they are not necessarily the same people. Okay. So that is number one. Before we continue talking about that, I do want to give you an example of where, in contemporary terms, we can all learn to be heroic. Now, I said the truth of the matter is that living Jewish life is heroic. It's heroic if you give up your vacations because you have to pay day school tuition. It's heroic because you'll never know what your cocktail is. I don't know if that's such a great thing or not, but you know, whatever the case might be. I have relatives who say, "You never had lobster? You never don't eat this? You don't eat that? You don't go here? You don't go there? You don't blah blah blah." No. We sometimes don't pat ourselves on the back enough. I mean, we shouldn't be totally self-satisfied. We don't pat ourselves on the back enough. Just how difficult things can be and how we're supposed to. And get the satisfaction of living a heroic life. By the way, that can be a lot of things. I was thinking about... sounds like the Arabs are davening Myrav. I was thinking about this the other day. I was thinking about, there's a lot of times when the kinds of values that Western society instills on us, and we get it for, in fact, there's a book I read a while ago called Primetime Propaganda, in which the authors argue that a lot of the moral and the social agenda of American society is set by TV. A lot of things that we believe in are an absolute anathema to the Western world. Okay, it just is. I mean, it's not. We don't have to get to extreme situations in which where they're taking on Brismila, and there are countries where they're trying to stop Brismila because it's not fair to the child, whatever the case might be. That means standing up to a lot of people. I have a friend who's a very prominent. He's retired now. Very prominent editor. He was the editor of Random House Publications for a long time, and he can't deal with it. I mean, he can't. He finds me a curiosity because he says, "I don't get it. How are you? You're supposed to be an intelligent guy. How can you believe in all this religion stuff? And you live on the West Bank, and you carry a gun, and you're fighting for a piece of land. Who cares?" This is a Jewish guy, of course. Even that kind of standing up for yourself is gevurah. And we all have that at some stage of the ballgame. And usually more often than not. It's gevurah to say, I have to leave work early on Friday in December because I got to get home for Shabbos. And no rabbi's going to give me a letter saying it's okay for me to do it today. That's gevurah. But there's another type of gevurah, which I think is about Jewish leadership, and this is a comment that the Rav made that I've quoted a lot. I published it a couple of times when I was the valedictorian of my smicha class. I used this, but it's an important lesson. And since we're in the era, we're in the period around hopefully getting more and more rain. You guys saw the Yoreh for the first time. Okay, now you know why it's called the Yoreh, like an arrow, because the first. Shoots of water come down like arrows. So we've always had the, I mean, as you can tell from saying Kriya Shema twice a day, you know that the whole question of whether where we stand with God is often expressed in the land of Israel by a question of is there rain or is there not rain, because we don't have any other sources of water by and large, and desalination is not filling any filling the bill at the moment anyways. But certainly before there was salad, desalination was possible. You know, it rained, it was fine. I remember the Arabs also feel like that. A number of years ago when we had a terrible drought, I was talking to a friend of mine who was an Arab, and he just looked at me, and I don't know why he decided to say this in English, but he tells me, Allah very angry. Allah, by the way, is a Kadosh Baruch Hu. We all understand that, right? Abdullah is a very, very good Jewish name. That was the Rambam's great-great-grandfather's name. That's why the Rambam's grandson's name was Ovadia. Of Abdallah Ovadia. In fact, Ovadia Yosef's real name is Ovadia Yosef Abdallah, because he was named after the Chacham Rashi of Baghdad, Bismano, whose name was Chacham Abdallah Somech. Anyways, that's great. The Mishnah in the first parak in Tanis has a long discussion about the fast. You know, is that the rain doesn't come after at a certain point, so there's a whole cycle of fasts and prayer services and stuff like that that you go into in order to pray to God to send rain. So the Mishnah says, this is in Tanis Daf Yud Alman Aleph, Higia Yudzayin b'Marcheshvan, if the 17th of Marcheshvan has come, v'lo yardu gishamim, and it hasn't rained yet, hitchilu ha'yechidim mitanim, gimel taniyot, that special, unique individuals, okay, start fasting quietly. You know, it's not a matter of like a public bombastic thing with 300,000 people in the kotel and all kinds of other stuff. Yechidim, they fast three taniyos. It was Monday, Thursday, and Monday. Ochlim v'shotim b'shechashecha. Then the Mishnah tells you what the terms are. Do they is it a 24-hour fast, 12-hour fast? Not important right now. So the Gemara asks a question. He says, who are the Yechidim? Who are these unique unique individuals? So the Gemara on the next Amud says as follows. Tana Rabbanan. Ezehu Yochid v'Ezehu Talmud. Who's a Yochid? Who's a unique individual and who's just a student? Okay, sort of like a Yochid in training, maybe? I don't know. Okay, who's a student? Okay. Yochid, a person who's a unique person, those people who will in the end, you know, go and you know, fast whatever. Kol sheroy lemanoso parnas alatzibor. Anybody who is worthy of becoming appointed as a communal leader. Talmid, a student. Kol shesholinoso dvar halocha belimudo vaomer vafilo b'masechet tekalim. A Talmud is a person who knows Kol HaTorah Kula. I'm going to go with one approach. There are two approaches how to interpret this line. Any single, you can ask him anything you want. He knows Kol HaTorah Kula, even this little Masechet in the back of the Shas that nobody looks at, very few people look at, called Masechet Kala. That's it. He knows everything. So we ask him, is that student? What would you call a guy who knows Kol HaTorah Kula? Person knows Kol HaTorah Kula. What would you call him? Call him rabbi. Okay? You call him Rosh Yeshiva. You call him when you have a shiloh, that's what you do. You know? So that's a Talmud? That's not a person who's singular? And that's not a person who's singularly wonderful? Not a person who is unique? No. Such a person is not unique. Who's unique? The guy that gets to be appointed to the leader of the leadership of the community. What, president of the shul? The president of the shul is better than the rabbi? Yes, sometimes the president of the shul, in fact, frequently, the president of the shul thinks he's better than the rabbi. But in the real world, you know, in the, you know, tachatas baklaria netzach, in light of the eye of eternity, you know, who's more important, who has a better status, the rabbi, the president? Anybody here follow the president of the shul? Anybody here, any of your fathers president of the shul? Good, okay. Not a, you think rabbin's not a good bad job for a Jewish boy? President of the shul's also. My brother's both a rabbi and a president of the shul, and believe me, the president of the shul was not a happy job. I mean, he did it well, but that's beside the point. In any event, I think he's much happier being a Rav. He's not a practicing Rav, but he teaches and stuff like that. In any event, the whole comment here makes no sense. So what is it? So the Rav said, look it. Obviously, and you see, this is what the Gemara drives at earlier. Obviously, you start off by being a Talmid and knowing a lot of Torah, but Yachid is one step above that. What are the qualities? What quality is there in the Yachid, the guy who's able to be appointed a leader of the community, which sets him apart? So here the Rav said the exact same thing we've been saying the entire time. Heroism. Gvura. A person who is a true leader, all right, who is worthy of being a leader, is a person who will transcend himself. In other words, who will not just look out for number one, he's willing to take risks. And he's willing to take risks for the community. It's very safe, it's like being powerful, to sit in yeshiva, to sit in academia, and just sit there and pontificate and talk about your knowledge and teach a little bit, and that's fine. There's no risk there. There's no risk there. The Yachid is the person who has knowledge, has the tools required, but he's willing to go out in the world, okay? And he's willing to be a leader. In the first time I heard the Rav discuss this Gemara, he said, if you're a posek, if you're a Rav, and to take public stands on things instead of being wishy-washy, that requires gvura, because people are going to hate you. People are going to disagree with you. Okay? But if you take a stand and you stare down the opposition, or you stand up for what you believe in, that's gvura. In other words, gvura is not necessarily just being shomer mitzvahs vis-a-vis the rest of the world. It also means taking a stand in terms of the rest of the religious world. Okay? I'll add one other, and with this we'll close today. I'll add one more position. So what is the Mishnah saying? Who are the ones who first fast? Really tired. Who are the ones that first fast? They're the Yechidim. What does that mean? It means that the people who are the Yechidim, the people who are willing to live beyond themselves, and to constrict themselves and let somebody else in. You know, some people who are so full of themselves there's no work for anybody else. A lot of divorces happen because of that. Okay? If you want a relationship, you've got to pull yourself in to let somebody else in. I've heard so many women and men who've told me that I couldn't get married to X, Y, and Z person because there's no room for me. Tzimtzum, restricting yourself to allow somebody else to get in there, is gvura, it's an heroic act, and it also allows for the creation of a relationship. In the case of the Yechidim here, these are people who get past their own egos and their own self-importance because they're such brilliant Talmidei Chachamim, and they intuitively feel the needs of the community. Notice the way the Mishnah says. The Mishnah says, if the 17th of Merchashven has come by and there's no rain, Yechidim Mitanim. It didn't say that Yechidim, that these unique singular individuals are told to fast. They do it on their own, because they find themselves being part of the community. Not just, by the way, the religious community, because rain is required by the entire Jewish community in the land of Israel, and the non-Jews. On their own, they feel the needs of everybody else, and they turn to God to be able to ask for others. Asking for others is also an act of gvura. Because the minute you say, I mean, what's the whole deal with the classic New York, I don't want to get involved stuff? or the classic, you know, general, I don't want to get involved stuff. That's what about me. Gevurah requires worrying about somebody else as well, because you restrict your ego and let somebody else's needs go in. And that was Yitzhak. Whether it was a question of institutionalizing Abraham's revolution, whether it was a matter of going along with Rivka's awareness of the fact, restricting his love for Esav, and realizing that ultimately he was, that Rivka was right, that Yaakov was the one who should inherit the promise of Abraham, or whether it was a question of being able to take a deep breath and let his father put him on an altar. It's a very important midah. It's a very important. It's a critical segue from Avraham Avinu to Yitzchak. So it's Yaakov. So the truth is, even though it's one parsha, Yitzchak is the critical link, which allows for the establishment of Yaakov's family, which ultimately becomes Klal Yisrael. Say there.